Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And from Milwaukee, I'm Sam Van Halgren. On this week's show, Adam and I celebrate Film Spotting's second anniversary and our 150th episode by giving you 10 reasons to never listen to Film Spotting ever again. Adam and I reveal the 10 films we're embarrassed to admit we've never seen.
Also on the show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Anne McHugh, and the Harryhausens, our Best of the Animation Marathon Awards.
But first, Adam and I spend some time with David Fincher and the rest of the serial killer-obsessed cast of Zodiac.
The Zodiac Killer has come to San Francisco.
Another letter. School children make nice targets.
He gave himself a name.
Greek, Morse code, astrological signs. This guy's used them all.
I like killing people because man is the most dangerous animal of all.
How does one do that?
I like puzzles. I do them a lot.
Got any hard suspects?
About 90 an hour. I'm up to around 500.
You got 4 crime scenes. Not a single usable print. You can't think of this case in normal police terms.
He's breaking the pattern.
In a recent Esquire magazine profile, director David Fincher explains, "You have a responsibility for the way you make the audience feel, and I want them to feel uncomfortable. Congratulations, Mr. Fincher. Mission accomplished." Whether it's the decaying body of a tortured victim gasping suddenly for breath in Seven, Edward Norton turning a combatant's face into meatloaf in Fight Club, or the convoluted plot twists and improbable ending of The Game, if you've seen a David Fincher film, chances are good that you've walked out feeling disturbed, disgusted, and possibly even degraded, none of which are exactly the stuff of box office gold. Fincher's latest, Zodiac, based on the book by one of the movie's main characters, Robert Graysmith, isn't likely to make audiences any more comfortable. For what could be more unsatisfying than watching three men, a San Francisco Chronicle reporter played by Robert Downey Jr., a Chronicle cartoonist played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and Mark Ruffalo's savvy San Francisco detective, exhaust themselves and the people they love trying and ultimately failing to catch the serial killer who terrorized Northern California in the late 60s and early 70s. Sam, I realize I'm painting with a broad brush here, suggesting that a sizable chunk of moviegoers will likely be turned off by a 2-hour and 40-minute crime movie covering parts of 4 decades that doesn't resolve the way Hollywood and television have conditioned us to expect. But what I really care about is whether you were left dissatisfied by Fincher's latest experiment in discomfort.
Yeah, as we discussed last week, this is among the most anticipated films of 2007 for us. And I look forward to every David Fincher film, but you gave me 7 or 8 reminders of why I shouldn't, maybe. I don't know why I look forward to these films of his. And thinking about Zodiac, let me quickly answer your question. I was not left dissatisfied. I really wasn't at all. There is something about David Fincher. You're right to point out, to mention the fact that, yes, he makes his audiences feel uncomfortable, but there's almost something almost lifeless about his films, about the characters in his films. And I have a theory that maybe David Fincher is actually just a product of artificial intelligence, that he's not actually human at all. And
could
maybe
be.
That's why he sort of creeps us out and gets under our skin like he does. I do admire his films, for the most part, the way they look. This film does not really stand out in terms of visually, I don't think. Of course, it's well-crafted and it looks good, but compared to other films of his, it's not so visually stunning, really. But as far as being satisfied by the film, what's strange is I think Fincher kind of falls into the same trap some of the Zodiac-obsessed central characters do, in that they become obsessed with something that ultimately isn't all that more interesting than your average Law and Order episode. And I think Fincher does too. He makes this epic length film about a subject matter which is certainly interesting, not uninteresting at all. Characters which are very interesting in their obsession. But the time and the detail he puts into it, I found didn't add up to much. The film does, I will say, get better and more interesting. And maybe the most satisfying thing about it is not solving an unsolved murder, but really the publishing of Robert Graysmith's book is probably the most satisfying thing you get, in that you get a result of an obsession in some way. But so was I left dissatisfied? No, but maybe I was just satisfied with it.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds like we're pretty much on the same page, though. I guess I disagree with your fundamental premise about where you come out on it and whether or not the case of the Zodiac Killer is inherently more fascinating than any other crime case or any other Law and Order episode. And I disagree. I mean, in terms of what I've seen of the Zodiac case and seen specials on it, it has captured my imagination more than other crime cases have. And I think there's something to say about the fact that he really was, if not the first, he was one of the first to actually capture popular culture's imagination. And Fincher does explore this in some way, where we actually get watches and symbols and people wearing buttons that have to do with the Zodiac Killer. And in some way, Fincher is definitely commenting on that. So I think there is something a little more to this case and just the crazy nature of it, not just the things he sent to the press. I mean, yes, we have the Son of Sam too, but cases like that that really are such front page news and then not resolved in the way this one so unsatisfying. Satisfyingly is, I think it does capture the imagination more than some of those things you said. So I disagree with you there on that, but I do think this film, one of the strengths of the film certainly, and I think you'll probably agree with me, is that it's one of the tensest, most creepy experiences I've had watching a movie. It's the most unnerved, certainly, I've been in a theater in a long time, and we talk sometimes about carrying the movie world out into the real world when we leave the film, and I swear to God, I got in a cab after this movie. And I sit down, the cabbie doesn't say anything to me, I tell him where I want to go, he turns around, starts driving, the doors lock. And I am sure, for at least 2 seconds, that this is not a cabbie at all, but it's the Zodiac Killer who's going to drive me out into the middle of nowhere and kill me. I mean, I really had that panic, I swear to God, for about 2 seconds after I walked out of this film as those doors locked, because I was recalling moments from the film. So it's effective in that way. And I think that what's really great is that Fincher elicits that tension and that creepiness by letting the scenes unfold in really subtle ways. And you're right in commenting that this film is more downplayed visually, more subtle than what we've seen from other Fincher films. He has a reputation as a really flashy director who always has a lot of tricks up his sleeves, but aside from some really great tracking shots where there's a lot of flow, I love the way he'll have counter direction happen in these long shots where someone's moving one direction and then people in the background are going the other, and it really draws your eye into the scene. There's a lot of movement. The frames are really packed with stuff, but it is pretty straightforward. And by doing that, he really does let our imaginations do all the work for us in the scenes where we think someone is about to be killed or where someone is actually killed. It's our imagination that is filling in all the blanks here, because Fincher is just letting the scenes play out, and it's really effective.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, too, I mean, I was never bored by it. If I'm comparing it to the average Law & Order episode, I like Law & Order. I think it's an interesting show that compels me. What they managed to pack into an hour, I feel like, you know, there is more room to play with there, and that's what Fincher's playing with. He's really getting into the detail of these people's lives. He's getting into the detail of this obviously fascinating crime or series of crimes. I guess, to me, what Fincher lacks in some way, and I referred to this lifelessness of it, the characters, he seems more interested in kind of physicalizing them in terms of psychologically. I don't think he has a real gift for getting underneath the skin of his characters and their motivations. And the screenplay does this too, where it sort of just paints characters as a certain way of behaving. And I think that's most kind of obvious in the portrayal of Robert Graysmith by Jake Gyllenhaal, an actor we've battled on, Adam, and I've re-embraced him occasionally. Brokeback Mountain, I thought he was very good, effective. Mm-hmm. Anyway, here I think he's just really miscast. I think the movie is largely really well cast, and Gyllenhaal is the one character, or the one actor in this case, that is playing a part. He's playing this kind of shy, kind of Boy Scout kind of kid. And he's got these wide eyes, and he's always mm-hmm. grinning, and it just doesn't work. And that was hard, because he is the central character in the film.
Sure.
And the journey we take is the journey that he takes in terms of delving into the obsession of this crime. And the fact is, the movie does get more interesting, and his character becomes more interesting when his obsession kind of reaches its peak. He loses his family. His family breaks down, and his sole obsession becomes the case in the writing of this book. And honestly, that's the interesting movie to me.
It's not that hard. You just got to know where to start. In the first cipher.
You actually carry that around with you?
Why?
No reason.
What's the most common double consonant in the English language?
Consonant?
The double L.
Double L.
And what's the one word that we know that he'll use in here at least once?
Kill.
Right, kill. So the Hardens start looking for double symbols, which they find here, here, and here, each with the same two symbols preceding them. So now they've got a repeating four-letter word ending with two symbols that they assume stand for L.
And since I think the whole word is kill.
And you got your K, you got your I, and you're on your way.
I think what's interesting is that we disagree on Gyllenhaal in the sense that even though I think his performance on the whole is probably one of the weaker ones in it, I love Mark Ruffalo in this film, I love Robert Downey Jr. in this film, and the supporting cast, you keep seeing these guys that you love just popping up in brief scenes, Donald Logue and Elias Koteas and Anthony Edwards, and then even, you know, at the end we get some James LaGrosse in there just for about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
It's really great. He isn't one of the better ones, but I actually thought he was perfectly cast in the sense that I thought immediately of something you said last week about Ryan Phillippe in Breach, how it was a great bit of casting to put him in a role where he has to play someone who people take lightly, just like people take Ryan Phillippe lightly as an actor, and it pays off. And here, Jake Gyllenhaal strikes me as exactly that, wide-eyed Boy Scout, someone who is a blank slate, someone who comes into a situation just like that, wide-eyed, really interested and fascinated, but not the kind of guy with maybe the depth who's going to become obsessed by it and act on it. And we actually get Robert Downey Jr. calling him out on the fact that all he's been doing this whole time is lurking and not doing anything. And so then
looming,
there's some drama,
yeah, right,
in the fact that he finally does do that. So whether or not overall, you know, he completely nails the role, I think that actually it was a great bit of casting. I think it was perfect. That's exactly what you would use Jake Gyllenhaal in a role like this.
Yeah, and I guess, well, I disagree with that statement. I just think he's badly cast because he's acting, he's performing, and everyone else has been cast to play variations on their persona. Gyllenhaal isn't, he doesn't work for me, it's a distraction, but ultimately the film comes down to, is the material the film covers worth the 2 hours and 40 minutes that Fincher devotes to it? And I'm going to say just barely, kind of. I think there are some great, great scenes. We talked about Breach last week, which I think is maybe, for me, a better film in some ways, more interesting, more compelling over the long haul, but Zodiac has better scenes. You talked about missing scenes that really had a kind of intensity in Breach. This film absolutely delivers on them.
Yeah, it does, though I guess we disagree ultimately on to what degree. There's a lot more I think we could say about this film, and hopefully we can get into it next week in listener feedback. But I especially love the way Fincher really deconstructs the crime movie, the cop movie genre here. A lot of allusions to Dirty Harry and Hollywood, and certainly in the way that Fincher tackles the lack of resolve that this film has, the unsatisfying ending, that in itself is a comment on the cop movie genre. So again, hopefully that's something we can get into next week. If you've seen Zodiac and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, Adam and I would like to announce that for the first episode ever, Film Spotting has gone completely green. We'll discuss last Sunday's Oscars, a.k.a. Al Gore Love Fest 07. Stay with us.
I came home from your bed in the morning of the new day. I came home from your bed. On your pillow I laid my head. In my long dress, my high heels, my fancy stockings, I was walking home from a long night. In my long dress, my high heels, fancy stockings, I was walking home from a long night in the bright light of day. Billboards line the streets in the morning of that new.
You're dealing with a culture that that parties on Saturday night, mm-hmm, and gets drunk and falls into bed with people they probably shouldn't be falling into bed with, and then they wake up Sunday morning and they go into church and they're still singing and still sweating and trying to get a little bit of salvation before Monday,
yeah,
and it all starts again. And living in the South, I experienced that ebb and flow, that cycle that of seasons almost during a work week even.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Van Hollegren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that was a clip from my interview at Sundance with writer-director Craig Brewer discussing his new movie, Black Snake Moan, which opens this weekend. It was our second favorite film from Sundance, one we told you last week to keep an eye on this spring. As I mentioned, it does open this weekend, and it's one of these films, Sam, where I think people will either love it, they'll love Brewer's brashness, his in-your-face approach, or they're going to find the whole thing completely ridiculous. I don't see any middle ground here.
Yeah, I think they could actually love or hate the trailer with the same vehemence. I mean, what you see in the trailer is essentially what you get, but I don't think it's fair to judge the film by the trailer in the same token. I think, put simply, it's the most exciting movie I've seen yet this year, and I think it's certainly among the most exciting films I've seen of this year or last year. It was thrilling to watch, certainly at Sundance with 800 people, with the cast and crew in attendance, but I guarantee this movie holds up under other circumstances. Some of the musical segments in the film, with Samuel Jackson totally selling the performance of this blues musician. I mean, he's really astounding. Again, just hold up as just great, great musical performances that are just viscerally thrilling.
Yeah, he really is fantastic in the film, Samuel L. Jackson and Christina Ricci. And again, the premise, real quick, is that Samuel L. Jackson is this old blues man who takes in, kind of has to take in, Christina Ricci's character, who is basically a nymphomaniac, finds her out on the road, all beat up, and decides that he's going to try to reform her by chaining her to his radiator. And so with that premise in mind, you can imagine the type of reaction it might get. And it's interesting because as we're talking about this, we did get an email just a few days ago from Jacob Jones in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who said, even after hearing your positive Sundance review of Black Snake Moan, I still can't help thinking there is no possible way the premise is going to work. I can't wait to see it, though. And that perfectly sets up, Sam, this week's poll question. We want to know just how intrigued by this movie are you? And again, you can check out our review of the film and my interview with Craig Brewer back on Film Spotting episode number 146. But the poll question this week, Craig Brewer's Black Snake Moan, ...
Yeah, I can't wait. Skeptical, but curious. Skeptical, will wait for DVD. Nymphos in Chains, not for me. I can't imagine who that could possibly be. Nymphos in Chains. Seems
true.
Like a guarantee hit. But obviously that's going to be the answer for some people. So again, yeah, just go to filmspotting.net and cast your vote there.
Yeah, we'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And it is a case where I think maybe now, Sam, we need to just stop talking about it because we're overhyping it.
We're building it up. We're now
inevitably
overhyping.
They're going to be disappointed now. So let's, speaking of hype, let's get on to actually last week's poll question. We asked you about the Oscars. We were curious how you were approaching the Oscars. And we asked you, again, the Oscars, I'll watch and hope they get it right. I'll watch, but know they'll get it wrong. I'll watch Ellen, or I'll watch when hell freezes over. Sam, how did it come out?
That's right. Well, 49%. I can't say how happy I was to read this. I'll watch and I hope they'll get it right. Look at the optimists in the crowd, really.
Yep.
29% said I'll watch, but I know they'll get it wrong. That's the cynic contingent. 14% said I'll watch when hell freezes over. That's beyond cynicism. That's rage. Mm-hmm. They watched the Independent Spirit Awards, I hope. And 8% said they would watch Ellen. I think last week I said, yeah, I'll watch and I hope they got it right. I think there were a lot of interesting races here at the mm-hmm. Oscars that I was that I felt like I had a stake in, and but I also watched Ellen, as I said last week, and I
right.
thought she did a great job.
Well, let's get into that a little bit more. I know some people are probably curious about our thoughts on the spectacle in general that is the Academy Awards, and you wrote about this a little bit this week in the Dope Sheet. What were your general thoughts on the night?
Well, part of it was just a general enthusiasm I felt like I had because I'd seen everything. And I think the past couple of years were the first 2 years for us, certainly, where we really had seen all of the nominated films and performances, with the exception
True.
Of the animated films and the foreign language nominees. But part of it, too, was the front runners, even, were people I feel like I could get behind. Forrest Whitaker, Helen Mirren, if anyone was going to be a front runner, these are the people I'd want to get behind in great performances. I also think, too, I don't know if part of it's knowing that a small contingent of our listeners are in the industry and having heard from a few of them, I found myself really invested in some of the smaller categories, you know,
yeah.
and even the short films. I thought the guy that won the award for best live-action short film, gave this really nice speech about what it's like for somebody who, you know, scrapes a crew together, scrapes some money together to make a short film like that, and then to get the attention like this at the Oscars, amongst all this other spectacle. It was really nice to see, and I felt like I really did appreciate moments like that.
Yeah, his name, I believe his name was Ari Sandell, and the film was West Bank Story, which I have not seen, but am very curious about now. And you're right, his speech was fantastic. It was one of those speeches where you almost can't believe that he's talking off the top of his head without any notes, because he was so articulate and so calm under that pressure of being under those lights and in front of all those people. I was really shocked about that. And I have to thank two of our listeners, Sander Weiss and his wife Sarah, for inviting me to their annual Oscar party. I did get a chance to go hang out there for a few hours, had a great time watching the Oscars with them and some of their friends. But I kept hearing the next day about how long the night was, and that's the old cliche about the Oscars, of course, and it did go past midnight if you were in an Eastern time zone. But I have to admit that I never watch all of the Oscars anyway, and here I drove back from Sandy's place about halfway through, and so I missed a good hour of it. And for me, that's okay, because not only does the ceremony usually drag anyway, and I find myself tuning out, but I just find acceptance speeches in general almost uniformly embarrassing. They make me uncomfortable to watch. I'm just waiting for someone to screw up, to say something ridiculous, to thank the wrong people or forget people or whatever. They drive me crazy. And so being able to miss an hour of it for me was perfectly all right.
Well, I think they're either really, truly moving, as I found Forrest Whitaker's speech. I mean, just that moment. I mean, we talked about this briefly, and you were worried for him. I honestly felt very moved by the moment he gave himself to take it in at the beginning of his speech, and I really found his acceptance speech moving. Helen Mirren really giving, among, I think, the most uncomfortable of the night, her whole gold star metaphor that she got from her sister. And maybe she was just really tired of giving awards accepted speeches, and she was down scraping the bottom of the barrel here. I sensed that a little bit. But I don't know. Overall, I was just really pleased. And I even found myself, I know I'm on the record as saying I was really rooting for Babel to win Best Picture and In Hour Two to win Best Director. But I have to say, at the end of the night, I was just so anxious for Scorsese, and I wanted him to win. Especially, you got the old the triumvirate up there of Lucas and Spielberg and Coppola, and it was almost as if it was predetermined, and everyone knew. And I have
to say,
I wanted it to happen.
Yeah,
even Departed winning Best Picture, I really found myself pretty thrilled by that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do disagree with you on Helen Mirren. I actually liked that metaphor of the gold star, and I thought her speech was really good until the end, that moment where she did the, and I give you the queen. I just didn't get it at all, and it left me I was kind of in shock for a second, like, what actually just happened? It was the most awkward end to a speech.
I think
all
she was
long.
Probably thinking, well, maybe nobody heard that part.
Maybe
the music came up, yeah.
Yeah, and but Forrest Whitaker's speech, I'm with you. I think all I said to you earlier is that he started out when he was taking it in, and he was kind of mumbling, and he was really kind of revving himself up to get ready to go, and I was like, oh my God, you know, is he going to fall all over himself, or is he going to be able to compose himself? And he did, and from what I've read, he did have some grief. He took some grief from people for his previous acceptance speeches at the Golden Globes and the SAG Awards. Apparently, he didn't really have anything planned out, and it didn't go over well. And so maybe with that in mind, that's why he was so prepared. And you're right, by the end of the night, his speech was really fantastic. I think, too, the one thing that really surprised me, and obviously I missed some of them in my drive back home, but the one thing they did right this year is even some of those interludes that are usually really annoying, like that dance troupe that did the symbols from the films and the sound effects interlude, that whole thing, those were actually interesting and fun to watch.
Yeah, I wasn't blown away by the dance. I was looking forward to it, and they did some incredible stuff. But I found myself being a little underwhelmed by that. But I agree, for the most part. I mean, I think we can agree, probably the best moment of the night came from Will Ferrell and Jack Black and John C. Reilly.
Without a doubt. Yeah. It was
Ryan Gosling, you're all hip, and now I'm going to break your hip right now. I mean,
really
justify the night for me.
All three of those performers are great. They were great there. And, of course, the sentiment that they're expressing is so true about how lonely a comedian is at the Academy Awards. Really
right.
Hilarious stuff. It did crack me up. So that was the highlight of the night. And You know, not that the awards were very hard to pick this year, probably, in the major categories. Certainly, everyone thought, including us, that Hudson was a lock for Best Supporting Actress, that Scorsese was a lock for Director, and then, of course, Whitaker and Mirren. But in those six categories that we picked on our show, we were both 5 of 6. We did pretty well. I predicted The Departed would win Best Picture. You predicted The Queen, so you got that wrong. But you were right about Alan Arkin winning for Little Miss Sunshine Best Supporting Actor, and I should have gone there,
really
too,
because nice to
I really felt like he would win, but I went with conventional wisdom that Eddie Murphy would take it. Really happy to see Arkin get it. Even, again, if he didn't deserve it as a lifetime achievement thing, it was great. So we did okay in our picks, and like you, I was really happy, obviously, for The Departed, one of my favorite films of the year, winning picture, Scorsese for director, the great Thelma Schoonmaker winning for editing, and William Monahan for writing. I've said it many times on the show, I think the screenplay has its flaws, but the dialogue is so good that it makes up for you know, any of the structural flaws that are there. So I was happy to see that. I'm not going to pile on it anymore, but a little bit happy to see Babel only get one, and if it was going to get one, for Gustavo Santaolalla's score, that was just fine with me. And, you know, Pan's Labyrinth was maybe one of the big surprises. You thought with all those awards, and it did win for makeup and art direction and cinematography, I thought for sure that it would win Best Foreign Language Film, but Lives of Others got it, and I can't really complain because we've heard nothing but good things about it. We actually plan to review it on next week's show, and it's entirely possible that I'll like the film even better than Pan's Labyrinth, so I'm not going to complain.
Yeah, I was so affixed to my couch, I actually hung around after the credits of the Oscar broadcast, and I actually saw they did note that you know, all of the nominees are chosen by members of their guild, but then the awards themselves are chosen by the entire Academy, with the exception of the short films and the foreign language films, which are only voted on by people that attend special screenings, which for me kind of explains why Pan's Labyrinth was able to win these awards, like you said, for cinematography, art direction, but lost Best Foreign Language Film, which I think is explained by the fact that The Lives of Others probably is as good as people are saying it is, but but also that it was also chosen by a smaller group of people who are probably pretentious film snobs.
That's a good point. I do think, though, you know, and I can't be too disappointed about Pan's Labyrinth winning any award, especially for its cinematography, which I did think was brilliant. But I really was rooting for Emmanuel Lubezki there for Children of Men.
Oh, me
both
too.
The editing
I was
and the
shocked,
cinematography, in that film are so fantastic. But again, happy to see Pan's Labyrinth get it. On the whole, I agree with you too. I said last week on the show that I wasn't typically an Ellen DeGeneres fan. I thought once she got past being tongue-tied and trying to make that whole joke about my dream versus your dream of being here, she kind of fell all over herself like we do sometimes here on the show. I said, hey, I've been there before. But she really did manage to make jokes that didn't work, especially work. She really did sell a lot of the humor, and I thought she did a really good job. I wouldn't
be
surprised a bit to see her back some year, and I wouldn't be bothered by it either. So I thought she did a good job.
Well, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater, and Adam and I finally close out our animation marathon with our Best of the Marathon Awards. Stay with us.
Dear, I'm right from these walls. Your majesty calls. Sun's beating down on wherever you are. And in my chastity, I want you to see my love's as strong as eternity. It's nighttime when I feel it most. It's the silence, the absence of light. And love's hard, but I'm staying true till the day that I come back.
It's time to take a look at what's new on DVD this week, brought to you by PureFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PureFlix.com.
Coming out new this week on Tuesday, Sam, I think the big release has to be a film that was on our list of the top 10 films of the year, made both of our lists, and that's Fast Food Nation, the Richard Linklater film. It actually features a commentary by Richard Linklater and Eric Schlosser. Would you agree that's the one people need to run out and rent first?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was kind of shocking how overlooked this movie was throughout the year, and I really hope people at least take our word for it, if nobody else's, and go track this down on DVD, yeah.
Yeah, a movie that definitely wasn't overlooked this year, also out, Borat, the Audrey Hepburn collection, Billy Budd, a film that I believe was one of the first overlooked DVD picks of mine, or I wanted it to be, but the fact was, it was never out on DVD, only on VHS. Well, now you can get Terrence Stamp, I believe, in his debut role as Billy Budd with Peter Ustinov, a great film based on the Herman Melville story, and Revenge of the Nerds, Panty Raid Edition. Sam, I think we're going to get into this in the next segment, but is this one of those 80s films that somehow you did not get to see?
Absolutely. Speaking of Anthony Edwards, too.
That's right.
I do know that he's in that. Have I seen it? No. No, I haven't.
Okay, well, you need to see it, a movie I watched 4,000 times when I was in junior high.
You were so badly raised.
A lot about me. Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Well, let's also get on to our donations this week. It's time to give out some nicknames. Sam, we want to thank the people that were so generous as to go to the PayPal link and throw a few bucks our way. Who is up this week?
We had San Theo Productions, Escape Clause Mafia, Michael Last of the Sandinistas, Chris Troubadour Luck Charm, Brian Faith for Four, Chris No Discipline for Nachos, and Christopher, That's Not a Dissident, That's My Wife. Thank you to everyone that donated to the show this week.
Sweet, it's my memory of you and of me, naked and clean, just like Adam and Eve, made love in the rain.
If we catch John Doe, and he turns out to be the devil. I mean, if he's Satan himself, that might live up to our expectations, but he's not the devil. He's just a man.
You know, see, you bitch and you complain and you tell me these things, and you mean that. If you think you're preparing me for hard times, thank you, but...
But you gotta be a hero. You wanna be a champion. Well, let me tell you, people don't want a champion. You want to eat cheeseburgers, play the lotto, and watch television?
Hey, how did you get like this? I want to know.
There wasn't one thing, I can tell you that.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we destroy a beloved screenplay, and you get a chance to win a free DVD. Last week, Adam and I massacred Seven, a tie-in with last week's top five most anticipated films of the spring. Seven director David Fincher directed Zodiac, which we reviewed in the first segment of this show. Adam, reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Well, before I do have to share one email, one comment from a listener.
I know
my
what's
favorite
coming.
Response was Gary Jellison, Mansfield, Ohio, who wrote in and said, "Now he has visions of Morgan Freeman telling Andy Dufresne, 'Do you feel lucky, punk?'"
Yes, in honor of the fact that Clint Eastwoodization of the Morgan Freeman lines from Seven.
Morgan Freeman. Yeah, so
I was all over the map.
You were all over the map last week, Sam. The winner is Kevin Mulqueeney at Washington University in St. Louis. Congratulations, Kevin. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
It is time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it ties in with our top five. We're going to get to, in the next segment, the top five movies we're most embarrassed to admit we've never seen. And this
That's
is a film that I know I have definitely seen. I believe you have seen it
I've
as
seen
well.
I've seen it, yeah. Although I really think, if I think about it, I saw this film on TV probably when I was 10 or 11. Although I have vivid memories of it. So
it is one of those films, though, that a lot of people need to see. It is a classic and maybe haven't. I can imagine a lot of our listeners out there feeling like it's one they're ashamed they've never seen. So with that in mind, that's why we picked it. I actually start this one out, so you give me the action.
That's right. And action.
We've borrowed money from every girl in the line.
Tomorrow we'll pay everybody something on account.
No. Tomorrow we go to the dog track and put everything on greased lightning.
You're going to bet my money on a dog?
I got it from the waiter. His brother is the electrician who wires the rabbit.
What?
He's 10-1.
Suppose he loses.
Don't worry. This job will last.
Suppose it doesn't.
Blank, why do you paint everything so black? Suppose a truck hits you. Suppose the stock market crashes. Suppose Mary Pickford divorces Douglas Fairbanks. Suppose the Dodgers leave Brooklyn. Suppose Lake Michigan overflows.
Well, don't look now, but the whole town is underwater.
And scene. All right, if you know what film Sam and I just massacred, what classic film, send us an email by Tuesday, March 7th to feedback at filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's show. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, just visit filmspotting.net.
I don't want to give it away, but I don't think screwball comedy is really our strength. I'll say that.
You don't think so, Sam?
I don't know if we have a strength, but if we don't have one, that may be it.
Frith made all the animals and birds, and at first made them all the same. Now among the animals was Elahrera, the prince of rabbits.
We'll have rice balls for lunch. Just hold on till then.
You stop that. You'll have porridge for lunch, too. Do you think a lazy slug like you deserves the same as people who are working so hard for our nation?
I don't care if Yubaba gets angry with us.
We're not taking humans.
She's already under contract.
What?
I promised to work very hard.
We are not going to take her in our department.
She'll stink up the whole place.
We don't want
3 days of eating our food and her smell will go away.
That's Atomo, the metal menace. He's not the hero. He's the villain. He's not like you. You're a good guy. Like Superman.
That was a montage from the six films that made up our six-week/4-month animation marathon. It was the marathon that never seemed to end. We watched.
It's because we love animated films so much, yeah.
That's right. Watership Down, Grave of the Fireflies, Akira, Ghost in the Shell, Spirited Away, and The Iron Giant. We had two films there. The bookends were, of course, more traditional animation. The four films in between were Japanese anime. And we are now going to close out the marathon, finally, the way that we always close out our marathons, with our awards. We're calling these the Harryhausens, in honor of Ray Harryhausen. And one of our listeners, Greg Nemec, wrote in and suggested that it didn't really apply since we didn't watch any films that were stop-motion animation, which he's legendary for. But, of course, as Greg also pointed out, he's one of those guys who's just a legend in the industry. I remember seeing Monsters, Inc., of course, the Pixar film, and they have a restaurant in there called Harryhausen's where they pay tribute to him. We thought we'd pay our respects as well. So we're going to hand out the Harryhausen's. We have five categories here, Sam, and I think we should go ahead and start with Best Character. Was there one character throughout this marathon that really stood out for you as the best character? I have a feeling maybe, unless something's changed, it's going to be one we heard about last week.
Yeah, it was. If we choose best character, we sort of toss it around, best hero, best character. And with best character, absolutely. The Iron Giant, the title character from Brad Bird's film, is just an astounding work of animated imagination, just in terms of how we learn about this character physically, how he transforms throughout the film. It's amazing how they portray this robotic character having a soul, and how he learns. It's just totally moving. I do want to throw in quickly, because I did have a separate character that falls more into the category of hero, and just to give some love to Watership Down, Bigwig and Hazel, of leaders of Watership Down. Bigwig, the kind of tough that puts himself in a bunch of scrapes, and Hazel, voiced by the great John Hurt, as the kind of motivator of the group. Great vocal performances there. Great, I think maybe the most heroic characters of all. Of all the films we saw, but of course the Iron Giant, absolutely, certainly makes the film worth seeing.
I definitely thought of the Iron Giant as well. You're right, he's a robot, he's obviously an Iron Giant, and yet by the end he absolutely breaks your heart. Really fascinating character. I was also tempted to go with Motoko's breasts from the movie Ghost in the Shell, a character in their own right, Sam.
It's absolutely, certainly memorable.
Yeah, so, but I did end up going with, actually, Seta from Grave of the Fireflies. This is the older brother, 12 or 13 years old, maybe, who has to take care of his young sister in Japan, World War II. Their town has just been bombed. Their mother has just died. He's responsible for their well-being. And unfortunately, I know we're going to end up talking about Grave of the Fireflies a little bit more throughout this segment, and I don't want to start weeping yet, so I'm just going to leave it at that. But Seta, to me, obviously, you talk about heroism, you talk about someone having to sublimate his own fears and anxiety and sadness about their mother's death and trudge on and find a way to live a life with his sister and take care of her. Really amazing character. That's my best character, which now brings us to best villain. You talked about maybe your best hero. There were some very good villains, including some good ones in Watership Down, which you might go with, in fact. But what did you give your Harryhausen to for villain?
Well, I really loved Kent Mansley, another character from Iron Giant, his sort of buffoonishness mixed with his menace. There was that's a great villain as well. But honestly, I am going to go with Grave of the Fireflies, the villain being war, starvation, and pride, really.
I almost did it.
It's
I'm
a
so
little
glad
unfair. Because, of course, these animated films are full of great villains, like the bad Warren of Rabbits in Watership Down, Yubaba from Spirited Away, the Puppet Master from Ghost in the Shell, Tetsuo from Akira. But really, I have to say there was nothing so villainous as really, you know, this what happened to this community, this Japanese community, after the American firebombing, really. What happens to people when they really are out for themselves? And, of course, what happens to our heroes, Seita and his sister, Setsuko? Just brutal. Nothing is so villainous as humanity itself sometimes.
Yeah, no, that is a really good choice. And I was tempted to go with Akira, because we don't get to meet Akira finally to the end, but he looms through that entire film. But really, I'm giving it to some other characters, a trio of characters in the classic anime film Akira, and they're called the Espers, numbers 25 through 27. These are these young, paranormal children that look like adults somehow. They're maybe the freakiest characters, single characters we saw throughout the animation marathon, and they come to Tetsuo really in his nightmares and torment him and try to kind of impose their own will about how they want things to work through these paranormal activities. They really are creepy for me. They're the best villains in the animation marathon.
It's a good choice.
All right, let's move on then to best moment or scene. Sam, what was it for you?
Well, you know what? I don't want to keep harping on Grave of the Fireflies, but it was so devastating. I just want to quickly mention the fact that I cannot shake to this day the look of the sores on the back of Setsuko, really, by the end of that film. Just completely traumatizing. But really one of my favorite scenes, another one from Watership Down, which was the rabbits figuring out a way to sort of raft across this river.
Right.
Without ever breaking the illusion that they're just rabbits. I thought that was really just a wonderful bit of imagination on the animator's part, where they really never broke this kind of illusion that these were rabbits, which was why it was so hard to watch them suffer, of course, but also to watch them solve a problem like that really impressed me and really stuck with me, even though we did see that movie in November.
That's true. Well, like you, I don't want to keep harping on Grave of the Fireflies, but I can't help it. For me, the best scene, or at least the scene that I can't shake, is what I call the Setsuko death montage. The moment it starts,
the moment we hear the music,
we start seeing Setsuko in her younger days, you know, several months ago, and closer to that, where she's
here
playing,
come the goosebumps, here come
voice.
The tears. Yeah.
Yeah, it just is the worst thing ever, and I will never forget sitting there watching it with my wife on our couch and just looking over and seeing the tears streaming down her face, and I'm thinking, I really want to start fast-forwarding this because I don't know if I can handle any more of this. It really is one of the most effective emotional moments I've seen on screen in a long time in terms of the impact it had on me. So for me, that's the most important, or at least the most memorable scene from the marathon, which brings us to our Harryhausen for visually stunning, and of course we've talked about a lot of moments that were fantastic throughout the entire marathon, but in terms of just the visual look, was there one film in particular that jumped out for you?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to give it to Miyazaki here. I certainly do, from Spirited Away. I think particularly of a moment fairly late in the film when Chihiro, our hero, goes to Yubaba's sister's house, and she has to go out on this train. The train tracks are covered in water, and there's this sort of long shot, and the movie just sort of stops and takes in this just astoundingly beautiful image of this water covering the train tracks, of the train coming into the station. I feel like in my memory it's like it's the end of a day and the sun is setting, and it just is mind-blowing, just gorgeous. And of course there's a number of beautiful, beautiful moments in Spirited Away where Miyazaki's imagination is on display, but that for me really stands out as a visually stunning scene.
Yeah, it is. And Akira is a classic animated film, anime, kind of the template for anime in some way, and so I consider that definitely, but I'm with you. It has to be Miyazaki in Spirited Away. I can't really say anything better than you said, other than the fact that it is just absolutely breathtaking. And I think that of all the films we saw, this film for me, and again, I've mentioned before, it's the only Miyazaki film I've seen, but I feel like just based on watching Spirited Away, it's the one film from our marathon where if you put in front of me another Miyazaki film, I could watch maybe 10 or 15 frames of it, you know, forget even just a few moments from it or whole scenes, and I could tell you that that's a Miyazaki film, whereas other films might fall into other kind of more traditional types of animation. I really feel like I could pick out a Miyazaki film right away just because of some of the images and the types of images he uses and the way it's drawn really is amazing. So I'm right with you there on Spirited Away. Which brings us to our final Harryhausen for Best Picture. I think everyone knows where this one is going. What was your favorite film from the marathon, Sam?
Yeah, best film, most devastating film, most memorable film, Isao Takahata's Grave of the Fireflies, 1988. And I remember something we noted during our review of Grave of the Fireflies, and it was that despite the fact that it does depict this kind of harrowing realism, the fact that it's animated it somehow distances it in a necessary kind of way. You know, watching the devastation of people dying and suffering would be almost too much. Of course, there are a number of films that do catalog these very same things, but there is something about it seeing animated that makes it more emotionally powerful, makes it harder to pull yourself out of the reality the characters are going through themselves. And I just feel like it was a great, great use of animation.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I think it is a case where the only way we could cope somehow, maybe the only way we can get through the film, and we barely could at that, is because it's animated and the juxtaposition of the beauty with the absolute horror of watching what is unfolding. And I know we've received, we talked about this, some emails from some people who were surprised at how strongly we reacted. Most people completely understood, talked about how devastating and tragic the film is, but there were a couple that thought we overreacted in a sense to it. And I don't know, I'm never going to be able to shake it. It's a film I tell people about all the time and almost warn them, you know, at the same time I want to urge them to see it. And then I also say, but maybe you don't want to because it really will affect you. And I mean, just thinking about these Animation Marathon Awards, having to go back and relive moments from Grave of the Fireflies was almost too much for me. I don't want to think about it anymore. We need to close the chapter on it.
That's right.
I think we're finally doing that. We're having closure here with our Harryhausens, hopefully. So that is our awards, and the marathon finally comes to an end. And again, for listeners who might be new here and wondering what we're doing with the marathons, and you'll hear a little bit about this actually in the next segment too when we talk about movies we're ashamed we've never seen. It really is something that kind of came out of that, where our marathons are designed to allow us to explore films and genres and filmmakers that we feel like we don't have a strong education in, a strong background in, and we're exposing ourselves and you, the listener, to it as well, and kind of dissecting these films a little bit. And so we close out finally the Animation Marathon, and actually next week we're going to kick off our Silent Films Marathon with a classic, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, the controversial Birth of a Nation. And if you want to get the complete marathon lineup and follow along at home, just visit filmspotting.net and click on the marathons link.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break. When we return, Adam and I put our credibility on the line and tell you the five films we're embarrassed to admit we've never seen. Stay with us.
You've got a nerve to ask me that in front of so many people, so many people. The sweet burden of youth wears your body.
All right, podcast listeners, it's now time to announce the winners of our Dope Sheet contest. Of course, we're giving away an iPod Shuffle, a blue iPod Shuffle engraved by Film Spotting, and a copy of Mike Judge's new film, Idiocracy, on DVD. We're giving them out to two randomly picked Dope Sheet subscribers. And Sam, let's go ahead and announce the big winner, this prize, the iPod Shuffle, courtesy of our friend and message board moderator, Alex Nesnick, in Dallas, Texas. The winner is...
The winner of the iPod Shuffle is Aaron Malone. Aaron, I believe it's the Handlebar Gumshoe.
Yes.
Malone. I love it when nicknames come back to haunt me. And I
there
wonder what was going through my mind at that time, yeah.
Well, I think it is a great nickname. I'm sure Aaron appreciates it. He signs it in his emails to us, so we must like it. And congratulations, Aaron. You are the winner of the iPod Shuffle. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will get that sent off to you. And now it's time to give out the second place prize. We have one other winner, again, the DVD of Idiocracy, and the winner of the DVD is Justin Farrell from Alliance, Nebraska, and that prize courtesy of Paul Minningham, our listener in the UK, Paul Symptoms of Majesty.
Symptoms
He's the
of
one responsible.
Majesty.
There you go for that prize. So congratulations to Justin and again to Aaron. Guys, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll mail those prizes out to you.
Nobody knows you. Nobody's ever gonna own you. As you go on.
The most anticipated movie of the spring for me is a pretty easy choice. I mean, what more could you want from a movie other than zombies, a serial killer played by Kurt Russell, and a girl with a leg cannon? My most anticipated movie of the spring is Grindhouse.
She tastes like trouble. With an attitude to boot. In Robert Rodriguez, Planet Terror.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. And that was a voicemail from Oscar in Stockholm. Nice to hear from him again, sharing his number one most anticipated movie of the spring. That was, of course, our top five topic last week on the show. And his number one was the same as our number one, Grindhouse, from Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez. We are, of course, dying to see that film, and it was great to hear from Oscar. And we will get to some more of your feedback on your most anticipated spring movies on next week's show.
Yeah, really. I mean, if more films just featured characters with cannon legs, really, I think they would immediately become our most anticipated films. I mean,
that's
it's,
true.
It's not hard. It's not a difficult formula to break, really.
Yeah, and it will be interesting to see if it does become a formula. What other variations right. on the cannon leg might we see from Hollywood in the near future? We'll have to
cannon
look
head,
forward to
cannon
that.
Arm. Yeah, sure. You can go.
There you go.
With that.
But it is time for this week's top five topic. It is the top five movies we're most embarrassed to admit we've never seen, and this is actually a redux of a previous top five from our second episode ever of Film Spotting. And I want to start off, Sam, by reading quickly an email from Jose Ferreira, one of our new listeners, big fan of the show, from, yes, say it with me, Sam, El Dudorino.
El Dudorino.
Portugal. Inspired by The Big Lebowski, of course. He is from Portugal, though, as far as we can tell. And he says, "Hi, Adam and Sam. Just found out about your podcast last week, and I liked it well enough to catch up with the old ones. One thing I wanted to point out, the fact that you already watched the five movies you were ashamed to admit you'd never seen 2 years ago or whatever it was, makes me wonder if you shouldn't renew that list every year or so. I'm sure there's still a lot of movies that would fall in that category for you guys. It doesn't even have to be five movies. It could be three movies or just one. You could even perhaps create a system to take suggestions from your listeners and commit yourselves to watch the one most people picked. Sorry if I'm rambling. I'm really just giving you stuff to think about." And we do appreciate that, Jose. You weren't rambling
indeed.
At all. It was a fantastic suggestion. One, when we read it, Sam, we instantly knew this was perfect for our 150th episode, a time of celebrating the past but looking forward of renewal to what's coming. And it is a great idea to renew this list every year because, of course, there are a ton of films we're embarrassed about, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
Oh, yeah, we're happy for the opportunity to talk about them, absolutely.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead and get us started. Your number five.
All right, my number five, like you mentioned, 2 years ago now, really, with our second show, I did have McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller from 1971 on there. We just saw it recently, actually, just in honor of Altman's passing. We loved it. So my number five is another Altman, actually. It's The Long Goodbye from 1973, kind of smack in between Altman's McCabe and Nashville in 75. It's Elliot Gould in this kind of deconstructionist film noir. I love Altman now that he's gone, and unfortunately he won't be making any other films. It's time for me to really go back and get the highlights of his filmography. The Long Goodbye is on the top of the list. Right below that, I think, is probably Three Women with Shelley Duvall and Sissy Spacek, a film from 77. So again, it's time for me to catch up with Altman.
Yeah, Long Goodbye is a film I love. As you mentioned, this revisionist take on the film noir, and I do love Elliot Gould, or as I call him, Elliot Gould.
Gould, so, yeah.
It is a good film, one you need to check out. And my number five is a film, Sam, that you have seen and I have not. And it's Ingmar Bergman's Fanny and Alexander. Man, it's hard to say some of these out loud, isn't it?
It really is. It's going to get worse, trust me.
The Virgin Spring, I've seen The Seventh Seal, Persona, Cries and Whispers, Wild Strawberries, Scenes from a Marriage. I feel like, you know, especially then when you've seen Woody Allen's films like Interiors, which is basically just a ripoff of a Bergman film, right. And I do like it very much, but I feel like I know a bit of Bergman, but I have not been able to commit myself to all 188 minutes of Fanny and Alexander. And that's edited down from a multi-part TV series. I believe 4 Oscars in 1982, including Best Foreign Language Film. I know it's supposed to be great. I know you really love it, Sam.
Yeah.
And
it was
I
my
love
intro
all those
to
other Bergman,
Bergman
films I mentioned, so I'm dying to see it. And yet I have not been able to make the time for it, and I need to. And I will before our 200th episode. That's what we're vowing with these films. We will have seen them sometime in the next 50 episodes. So Fanny and Alexander is my number 5.
All right, well, my number 4. God, I love going from Bergman to this. And really, this film really encapsulates an entire genre, maybe even a decade of films. And I think this is the case where most frequently when I have to say, you know what, I've never seen that – you know, the shock enters people's eyes, most frequently yours, Adams.
Yes.
And again, like I said, this is more of a place filler, but I'm saying 16 Candles, okay? I've never seen it. Going from Bergman to 16 Candles, that's embarrassing enough. And admitting that I've never seen it may be embarrassing as well. But like I said, Pretty in Pink I've never seen. First Blood, Vacation, Rambo, Commando, Porky's, Meatball, Some Kind of Wonderful, Revenge of the Nerds, Red Sonja, all of them. Any R-rated movie from the 80s that my mom would let me see. I still haven't seen it. So really, I'm going to have 2 slots here. My number 4 is 16 Candles, I guess, from John Hughes, Molly Ringwald, and the whole Brat Pack. And then a title to be named later, Adam, that
yes.
I'll let you and maybe our listeners as well fill.
Fantastic. Actually, that's fantastic, Sam.
That's fantastic.
Me and the listeners, we're going to conspire and figure out what 80s film you absolutely need to see. I mean, you're right. You just finally, fairly recently, caught up with Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
It's true.
You missed all those great 80s movies, and it's sad. It's tragic. I have no idea. I think that's more embarrassing, frankly, than not
than
seeing
Bergman.
The Long Goodbye. So
absolutely.
It's worse than
yeah.
Bergman. You have no credibility anymore, Sam, but no. We'll give you a pass. We're going to help you out. We're going to pick out a nice
It is. It's
feature.
A cry for help. That's what this top 5 is all about.
It is. It's a cry for help, and I'm definitely going to need it here after I reveal my number 4. Let's actually go ahead and hear a clip from my number 4.
I shall want quite a lot of money.
All it is. Not that much. The best of them won't come for money. They'll come for me.
That's a clip, of course, from Lawrence of Arabia. When Sight and Sound did their list in 2002, they asked critics and directors to name the best films ever, the top 10 films of all time. This was on the director's list, Peter O'Toole, back when he was pretty much the prettiest man in the world, and it's supposedly the best performance ever, according to Premiere Magazine, as we discussed several months ago on the show when they put together that list. But, you know, it's one of those cases where David Lean has never really excited me. I've seen a few of his films, and I've never really been into those big kind of sweeping epics. But also, just like with Fanny and Alexander, it's 202 minutes long. And between family and jobs and film spotting, how do you make time for 202 minutes? But I
yeah, where's
to do
the
it,
90-minute version of Lawrence of Arabia? That's what I want
Where
to
is it? Can someone make that for me, please?
The 85-minute version of Gone with the Wind? Bring it. I'll see it.
I would watch that tonight if I could find that, but
all right, well, my number 3, it's a film that has come up so often for your top 5s, Adam, and it's a film we've even massacred in Massacre Theater. It's Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. I've never seen it. Barbara Stanwyck,
oh my
Fred
God.
McMurray, this film noir. I don't know if I've ever even admitted that to you. I've just sort of gone along with it. I've been like, oh, Double
shocked.
Indemnity, great pick for Massacre Theater, Adam. Great, great film. Great performance by Barbara Stanwyck. Of course, we saw her during our Screwball Comedy Marathon in the Lady Eve. She's absolutely incredible. I can't wait to see this film. It's not like you with Lawrence of Arabia where I just can't find the time or I don't have the interest.
Right.
I need to see this film.
One of my favorite films of all time, if not in the top 10,
number
38
on the AFI Top American Films list. I mean, it's an embarrassment.
I cannot wait for you to finally see that film. But speaking of embarrassments and the AFI Top 100, I can't believe I'm admitting that I have not seen North by Northwest, my number 3. It's Hitchcock. It's one of Hitchcock's best, according to everyone. I even have a man crush on Cary Grant.
That's
and
true.
There really is,
on the record.
Like you, there's no excuse with this film. It's not that it's too long or anything else. It's just one of those films that I have not been able to see for some reason. And we left it out of our Hitchcock marathon even just because you had already seen it. We wanted to pick movies that were maybe a little bit more obscure. And so we went with one in that place that we both hadn't seen, but North by Northwest, I know there are iconic images from the film. I would recognize it immediately if it came on a screen, and yet I've never seen it.
All right, well, my number two, Les 400 Coups. Okay, and if you don't know what that means, then you can't be angry at me that I've never seen the 400 Blows from François Truffaut. Number 48 on this really great compilation list can be found at theyshootpictures.com. Really a compilation of lists, Sight and Sound, AFI, Critics List. It's number 48 on the best 1,000 films of all time. I just need to see it. It's Truffaut's debut film. I've actually said, Adam, I've encouraged us to do a marathon in French New Wave. You've actually covered a lot of this ground in film school, so I'm going to have to do it all alone. So the 400 Blows, yeah. That's number two on my list.
Well, one I have seen, fortunately. But jumping to my number two then, let's go ahead and hear a clip. We're going to get it announced from my good friend Woody Allen. Here it is.
That's that.
Why don't you call her?
No, I would never do that. I think I blew that one, you know. I really kept her at a distance, and I just would never give her a chance. And she was so sweet, you know. She called me. She left a message with my service about a month ago that I should watch Grand Illusion on television, you know, and I never returned her call or anything.
Grand Illusion from Jean Renoir, and this is a tie. Renoir's Rules of the Game is also in here. I have not seen either. They're both classics. Rules of the Game is on that Sight and Sound top 10 list on the critic side. Both are required viewing in a lot of intro to film analysis classes, but not when I took it, apparently. Wasn't in my section, and I need to see both of these films, and I will. I'm vowing, Sam, I will.
All right, well, my number one, this is like profound embarrassment here, because I know we've even talked about it on the show, and I may have even suggested that I'd seen it, because listeners had written in about it, and it is Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. Number six on the best 1,000 films of all time, if you go to that theyshootpictures.com. I don't know what to say. I mean, it's a classic film that has influenced any number of filmmakers and other films. It is number one for a reason, because it's the film I need to see most of all of those on my list, even more than 16 Candles, I'd say.
Yeah, I would say that's fair, even more than 16 Candles. And you could probably even add into that the film that it definitely inspired most clearly, and that's The Magnificent Seven, the Western with Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen, which you haven't seen either, have you, Sam?
Why are you doing this to me?
Why am I piling on? I'm just that kind of guy.
I just didn't think it was fair to see that before I saw the original, really. That was my thinking.
That's certainly true, but my number one, I brought up Magnificent Seven. Speaking of Westerns, everyone had to see this one coming, though I'm sure most of our listeners were hoping that by this point we had gotten to it already, and it is the film Once Upon a Time in the West from Sergio Leone, 1968, this epic Western. We've received so many emails from listeners over the 2 years we've done film spotting now who have told us that we have to see this film. I even went out and bought the DVD, I believe with listener money, donated money to go out and buy movies like this that we needed to see. Once Upon a Time in the West, I own it. It's sitting on my shelf. But again, one of those cases where, despite how excited I am to see it, it's 165 minutes long.
It just comes down to time for a lot of these things. Absolutely.
I know. I just need to make the time for it, but I am dying to see it. It's come up so many times on top fives, and I alluded to this in the last segment with our marathon awards, where Once Upon a Time in the West is actually kind of responsible for our marathons, which we've done 8 or 9 of them now at least, because it was the film that came up so many times in listener top fives, and we were so embarrassed that we hadn't seen it that we said, you know what, we really haven't seen hardly any Westerns. We should do a Westerns marathon, and that's what we did. That was our first one.
And of course, we left off Once Upon a Time
in the West because we wanted to go back and see some of the classics, but nevertheless, that is the film that I am most dying to see, and I feel like a good chunk of our listeners anyway are most dying for us to see, and so it is my number one.
All right. Are you still with us out there, Film Spotting Nation? I hope so. Those are the top five films we're embarrassed we've never seen. All right. Well, opening and wide release this weekend, Zodiac, which you heard us talk about earlier in the show, Black Snake Moan, and Wild Hogs. Next week, we'll discuss best foreign language film winner, we hope, The Lives of Others.
Thanks to Ann McHugh and Messenger Records for this week's music. More information is available at messengerrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by the new PeerFlix. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com.